I agree with Mr. Smellie. The feast was terrific. It was a tremendous spirit. I've heard that from most feast sites, but certainly want to share my observations at the feast. There was a tremendous spirit of peace and of joy and of excitement and energy, enthusiasm. It was just a tremendous feast in every way in Park City. Most of us who've been to the feast for 40 or 50, or in our case 51 times, realize that the sermon's actually a little different in Park City this year than they usually are. Not the standard classic statements that are necessary, of course, over and over, but modified a little and coming at different angles, and very positive and very encouraging and very educational material that kept everybody, I think, alert and sharp. So we had a very good feast, no negative incidents of any kind, and just was a very positive time for everybody concerned. And we, of course, enjoyed seeing many of our brethren from our former Salt Lake City congregation, as well as our Grand Junction, Colorado congregation. And just a joy to see people after six or seven years since we have left there. So we had a good feast as well. And any of you want to tell your stories over potluck or with pictures or whatever that don't have the opportunity to stand up here, feel free to tell your story anyway in whatever venue you can find. In the spirit of meat in due season, I thought it would be a good time to talk about keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Sometimes when we talk about keeping the feast and we talk about some of the necessities of keeping the feast, it's a little too late for some folks to apply the information or the principles that were given. In most cases, in this room, without getting into personalities, most of us know about the feast, we keep the feast, we prepare for the feast, and yet it's necessary from time to time to give that meat in due season and to remind us of things that perhaps we already know, but to convict us of the need to continue in the practices that God has instructed us to keep. And the Feast of Tabernacles, of course, we often call the highlight of the year for God's people. And I think that's probably a true statement, even though we recognize that you can't separate out one or the other of the holy days or the feast days and say this one is the most important or this one is the highlight. Obviously, we couldn't have the Feast of Tabernacles without the Passover, could we? If Christ hadn't died to pay the penalty for our sins, it wouldn't matter whether we're keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. So you can't separate them out. But in terms of the planning, the preparation, the travel, the amount of money we spend, the amount of time we spend, obviously the Feast of Tabernacles sort of stands alone, and even though it doesn't stand alone because the last great day is attached to it, but we have a very special event, and of course we need to keep that ever in mind and practice it in the way that the church has done for now about 80 years. In order to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, of course, we first need to know why we keep it. So let's go back to that very familiar scripture that's usually mentioned in the context of the offering in Deuteronomy chapter 16, because it says it very succinctly in Deuteronomy 16:16. Three times a year all your males shall appear before the Eternal your God in the place which he chooses, at the Feast of Unleavened Bread, at the Feast of Weeks, and at the Feast of Tabernacles. So we understand this to mean three seasons of a year. There's the spring season feast of the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, the summer seasonal feast of Pentecost, and then, of course, the fall seasonal feast of Trumpets, Atonement, Tabernacles, and the Last Great Day. And so we're instructed or commanded to appear before God three times in a year, three seasons of a year. And, of course, it goes on to discuss coming before God with an offering, because the Feast of Tabernacles is an act of worship before God. We are commanded, in other words, to go. In Leviticus chapter 23, Leviticus chapter 23, beginning at the beginning in verse 1 of Leviticus 23. Verse 1, and the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, the feast of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, these are my feasts. So these are God's feasts, and he lays them out here in this chapter, beginning in verse 3 with the Sabbath day, and then going on down through the various feast days. And in verse 33, of course, we come to the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of this seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Eternal. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation." Excuse me. "On the first day there'll be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it." Well, he goes on to say, "For 7 days you shall offer an offering," etc. Verse 37 repeats, "These are the feasts of the Eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, and to offer an offering," and so forth. So God commands us to go and keep the feast, to keep the holy days, to keep the Sabbath day, to keep the holy days, because they are acts of worship to him. In other words, the feast is a spiritual event, even though in the case of the Feast of Tabernacles, the spiritual lesson is taught in a physical experience. That's why you always hear us stand up and talk about opening night and the first day, that we're here to learn to fear God and to rejoice. And those are kind of mutually cyclical, as we've said. If you rejoice before God, then you learn to fear God. And if you learn to fear God, then you're able to even more greatly rejoice. And so God sends us there to rejoice and to learn the spiritual lessons and, of course, to experience the physical well-being, the camaraderie, the fellowship, the peace, the safety, the security, the love, the caring for one another that is the primary focus of the Feast of Tabernacles, serving God together as his household, as his people. And as we've heard these reports today, and we'll hear more reports next week, and as we talk among ourselves and fellowship today and talk about our feast experience, of course it's a combination of both physical and spiritual. It's a combination of enjoying the beauty of God's creation and of enjoying the physical good things of food and drink and the blessings that God has provided for us. But it's also a spiritual experience of coming to understand more of God's way and God's truth and God's purpose, and hearing the messages and hearing the stories, because often some of our best lessons at the feast might come from listening to somebody else's story of conversion, somebody else's story of miracles in their lives, somebody's story of how much different their life is today than it was before they were called. Most of us today have been in the church quite a long time, except for our younger members, of course. And so we often maybe don't recount those stories as well as we should. Judy and I have been friends with Jack and Mary Hendren since 1974. So that's coming up on, 40 years? That's coming up on 40 years that we have been friends. And when I say friends, we have traveled to Africa together. We have kept the feast together on several occasions. We've spent numerous nights in each other's homes. Our children have grown up together. We have known each other well. And yet we sat down over a couple of meals on this trip and discussed things about our history and about our conversion, about our calling, that we don't remember ever discussing before. That was remarkable to us. We're driving down the road, and Judy said, "Can you believe that we have never discussed that before?" It was just not only interesting, but exciting, because we learned things about each other we hadn't known and hadn't shared. And that, of course, is part of the process of the feast, whether you're traveling together, whether you're living together. And we had a situation in Park City where there were lots of condos and big homes and, you know, mountain ski resort homes and this kind of thing. And several of us had rented those, and there were several families living together in some cases. And people who had known each other in past times and don't live nearby now and came together at the feast. In some cases, families like ours, which was an extended family all living in one place. But it gives an opportunity to visit and fellowship in a way you just don't normally have, even at the feast, if you're staying in a private hotel room, or even in your own little condo. If you're living with other people, there's just ongoing conversation and interaction that you don't normally have. And, of course, we extended that by taking the trip after the feast as well. But we need to know that God tells us to go, and we need to know it's to learn to worship and fear him by rejoicing before him in the good things that he tells us to eat and drink and enjoy. Now, of course, to do that, we also need to have the time to do it. We need to have the time off from work or school or whatever other obligation we may have, maybe a time off from retirement, to be able to go to the feast. Well, I'm serious. Sometimes in retirement, I understand people get as busy and have as many crazy obligations or feel as limited as they might if they're working. But we have to have the time off, and we have to plan ahead in order to go and keep the feast. So starting now, right after the Feast of Tabernacles in 2013, we all should be thinking, what do we need to think about? What do we need to plan? How do we need to prepare for next year's Feast of Tabernacles? For example, saving the money starts now. Planning to take the time off work, whether it's vacation time that some have to take, or whether it's extended vacation time or personal days or whatever your employer or your business allows, or you allow yourself as your own boss in some cases, it's time to do that now. Now, it's too early to notify schools and people like that. That's not really necessary. But it is necessary to start thinking in terms of some brethren have had to say at times past, I have to save. I was hoping not to do that. And I have to make it a point not to. Some brethren have to say, I have to set aside a certain amount of my vacation for the feast, and I can only take private time or personal time to the degree that I have time left over after that feast time. Now, many of us today have a little more flexibility than that, but many still do have only 2 weeks, let's say, of vacation that is paid vacation, and getting the time off and being able to handle the economic pressure of not getting paid for whatever extra time they take off can be a bit daunting. And if you're in business, of course, knowing how you're going to handle that, how you're going to manage closing your business during the holy days and things of that sort is always a bit of a challenge. So planning ahead is an important part. If you know you need to go, then you have to plan for it. And planning ahead and letting other folks know who are involved, who are affected by your actions, is an important part of the process. Now, obviously, if you're going to go to the feast, whether it's in Kerrville or maybe Galveston next year, I think now it is Galveston, or whether you're going off to Europe or India. Now, I haven't been coughing like that all day or I would not have come, but I don't want to impose myself on any of you. You have to have money. You can't just get in the car and go to St. Augustine or Pigeon Forge or Salt Lake City or get on an airplane and fly to Hawaii or fly to Europe or some other place without money. So you have to have money for expenses. And, of course, God provided that system. It's not a system man can accept, not a system that's very popular with family members sometimes when you tell them how you are financing your 8-day Feast of Tabernacles and the travel that is contiguous with it. But nevertheless, it's something God tells us to do. Leviticus chapter 14. Now, God obviously knew. I'm sorry, Deuteronomy, you know that. Deuteronomy chapter 14. God obviously knew when he commanded Israel to keep these days that they would find all kinds of good reasons not to keep them. And one of the primary reasons would be, we can't afford it. Even back in the days when they were shepherds and farmers, picking up and leaving home and going to another place for a period of time would be a challenge. And God knew that, and God provided for it. In Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, again, most of us have learned this many years ago. Old-timers can probably quote it to you. You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Eternal, your God, in the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. Now, there are plenty of scriptures to show you that you come to before God, that you pay a tithe on your increase, and that you come before God with offerings. But here he specifically says you will eat this tithe that you save year by year. And it's a tithe of the grain and the wine and the oil and the firstborn of your herds even. So that firstlings of the flock were included in this tithe that is to be eaten before God in the place where God chooses to place his name. Now, in that period of time, God placed his name in a certain location in Israel, whether in Bethel or whether in Jerusalem or whether God placed his name and said, come here to do this. And so it is a tithe that is eaten before God. Now notice in verse 24, but if the journey is too long for you so that you are not able to carry the tithe. And here in America, we rarely think of carrying the tithe, but some of us remember back in the early days of Big Sandy when everybody was camping, that some people actually did come carrying their garden produce, canned in some cases, carrying various items from home that they would be able to eat while they were at the feast. They didn't all come and go right down to the grocery store to buy groceries. But most of us did, and most of us still do. In other parts of the world, it wasn't unusual to hear stories. Somebody would go to the feast in Mexico, for example, 40, 50 years ago. It's not so much that way now, but they go to the feast, and they would come back and say people were coming to the feast carrying their chickens and, carrying bags of this and that and the other thing on the train. Now, you would literally get on a train and people would have chickens with them because they were on their way to the feast. God says, okay, most of you may have a little difficulty doing that. So if the journey is too long for you so that you are not able to carry the tithe, you can't take your grain and your oil and your flocks, or if the place where the Eternal your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, when the Eternal your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. Take the money in your hand and go to the place which the Eternal your God chooses. So God said the increase year by year is to be set aside for this purpose, but in many cases you're not going to be able to gather it all up and haul it with you. So you can sell it. Exchange it for money. In our cases, in most cases, it comes out of our paycheck anyway. It's already money. We live on a cash economy. Well, we live on a credit card economy, but we intend to be living on a cash economy. We don't barter very much. We don't carry around our goods. We carry money. And so God says, turn it into money. And take the money in your hand and go to the place which Eternal your God chooses. And you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. So God provided a system that, again, is remarkable to the average human being who says, what? You spend 10% of your income. That's a 10% tithe of your net income. You spend that in 8 or 10 days of the Feast of Tabernacles? Are you crazy? Well, of course, God wants us to live abundantly during the feast. The idea is to go and be able to have things you wouldn't have the rest of the year. The idea is to be able to go and enjoy the physical things that God has blessed us with and to rejoice before God and picture a time of abundance, a time when everybody has enough to eat. A time when it's not just having enough to eat, it's having the good things, or what he sometimes calls the fat things of the earth. And so he sets aside, he tells us to set aside, that tithe for the purpose of keeping the feast. Now most brethren have long since learned that and applied it and practiced it, or else we wouldn't have thousands of people showing up at the feast. In Park City, we anticipated 400 people. We finally allowed 500 to register. On the first morning, we had 539. So there are hundreds of people traveling to exotic locations and keeping the feast because they keep this command from God to set aside a tithe for that purpose. And they go and they rejoice before God. Now, many of us also live in nice homes. We drive nice cars. We eat decent food. So maybe we don't splurge as much on the elaborate physical support things as we might have in years gone by when the church tended to be probably a little less economically advantaged. We hadn't learned a lot of lessons. We hadn't been blessed as much as we have today. And many, many people came to the feast with little. But they were able to spend 10% of their income and actually live a little better than they might live the rest of the year. But there are people, and I could describe them for you, people who can come to a place like Park City or a place like probably St. Augustine or Pigeon Forge or any of the others we've heard about and live rather elaborately if they choose to, opulently if they choose to, and eat the best food every day if they choose to, or do the most fun things that they can find to do day in and day out because they can afford it. Because God said, you can't just say, well, I make too much money. I only need 2% of what I make to have a feast. But rather, you save a tithe and you spend that tithe. Now, there are other things to spend it on, and we'll get to that in a moment. Because not only do we have to plan in advance for the feast, but we have to have a plan of how to make the feast successful and how to put our energy and our money and our planning into certain things to make it happen, to make it successful. And part of that, of course, is a good budget. Sometimes people think, I suppose, that I have more money than I have any other two-week period of the year. I don't need a budget. I'll just go and spend what I spend. I've been there and done that, and that usually means overspend. That usually means you come home broke. And not only with all of your tithes spent, but with some of your grocery money or whatever else it is spent as well. But it is good to have a budget, again, as a guideline. That doesn't mean you can't overspend your budget. I suspect that Judy and I overspend our budget every year. But that's a conscious decision. It's a decision that, okay, here's how much tithe we have. Here's how much we can do on that. But we're willing to spend a couple of $100 extra for this event or for that event. And, of course, in this case, this year, we took the extra trip, which was out of our own pocket anyway, to a very large degree. So having a budget, at least as a guideline, to help you know what you have and how to spend it is a good idea. And, again, when you start thinking about next year, maybe you can already anticipate how much money you're going to have. Maybe your job is secure and your income is stable and it's predictable and you know how much you're going to have next year. And so you can say, I'm going to have enough money to go somewhere that costs a little bit more money next time. I'm going to have enough to go to an exotic site somewhere or a far distant site. I can afford to fly or I can afford to do these things that I need to do. So it's a good time to be thinking about that. Good time to be planning ahead. We won't know exactly where the feast sites are until the spring, will we? But you can kind of have an idea in your head, do I want to just go to a routine site or do I want to go to my home site? Now look, I had a great time in Kerrville last year. I would not try to compare Park City and Kerrville. They're two completely different places with completely different attractions, completely different reasons to go, different time, different circumstance. But you can go to either one and have a great feast. And, next year for me, I'm quite confident it'll be Galveston because I'm supposed to be at my assigned site, and that'll be my assigned site. So that's fine. I'll plan to have a great feast in Galveston. You might be able to plan to have a great feast somewhere else. But it takes some planning. It takes some thinking, at least preliminarily, to say, can we afford the time? Can we afford the money? Can we do the things that it would take to do something a little more elaborate than just go to the local feast site? If you can, then more power to you. God will bless you according to your ability to go and use what he's blessed you with and rejoice before him. Overspending in the sense of hurting your daily budget, your weekly budget, your monthly budget when you get home is not a good idea. Stretching your resources beyond what you can handle when you get back, leaving yourself with all kinds of problems is not what God intended for the feast. if your tithe is according to, is lower than you really can afford to do something elaborate, then don't do it. It's as he said in Deuteronomy 16, I didn't read that part, but in the offering he says, every man shall give as he is able. Well, in this case, because the feast site is no longer at one central location like Bethel, the feast is here and there and all over the world, and you can go to whichever site you can afford. But don't go to a site you can't afford and leave yourself hurting after the feast. That isn't a good way to rejoice before God. Now, if you have extra money and you want to add some money to your feast tithe, of course, you can do that, and that's quite all right. But you should live within your means to the degree that you consciously decide this is what we can afford and this is what we're going to do. We will not be back in Park City next year. I think all of those of us who were there know that. But we are currently looking at returning to Steamboat, Colorado, which is a very popular site with Texans. And of course, Texans dominated the Park City site and they will dominate the Steamboat site. But it will not be the Steamboat Grand where it's been before. We are currently in negotiation with the Sheraton across the road from the Steamboat. And I think the biggest issue there will be that we'll have another major group meeting in the Steamboat Grand, and we'll be across the road in a similar and maybe even nicer facility in some ways. That bridge hasn't been crossed, but that's probably what's going to happen. So we may end up with us and United across the street from each other, which for some people they count as a blessing because the family's divided and they can go and have a family get together and people go to different services. It's a little bizarre, but it's where we are today. So we'll see how that happens. Now, the budget, of course, for the feast should also include sharing or serving others in whatever way that might be appropriate. Judy and I were, I think I can speak for her, we were both a little overwhelmed on the Day of Atonement as the feast approached, and we came into services, and you would have thought we were already at the feast. People were passing around baskets and gifts and cards, and it was a very celebratory Day of Atonement, you put it that way, because it happened to be no Sabbath in between. It was the last time we were going to be together before the feast. And so lots of you brought feast gifts to one another. You passed on various cards and greetings and so forth. And it was quite a celebration here as we got ready to go to the feast. And obviously all of that has to be, again, kept in balance according to your budget and to why you're doing what you're doing. But God shows us in the book of Nehemiah that that's an appropriate thing to do. Let's go to Nehemiah, look at chapter 8. Nehemiah chapter 8. Notice in the beginning, verse 1, now all the people gathered together as one man in the open square that was in front of the water gate, and they told Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Eternal had commanded Israel. Now, you look here and you see that Ezra starts to read and all the people stand up, and one of these verses says that he was standing up above all the people, sort of in a pulpit like I am, but the people stood up. But then it goes on to say he read in the book from morning until noon. So we're back to the days of the Gerald Waterhouse sermons and the 3.5-hour services we used to have. But the point is that this is the holy day. If we look at verse 2, it says, so Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly of men and women and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. So that's the day of trumpets, the first day of the seventh month. And so Ezra reads the law and reads about the feast and keeping the feast. Verse 8, so they read distinctly from the book in the law of God, and they gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading. Verse 10 says, then he said to them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. This congregation has done that in spades the two years that I've been here. There is plenty of effort on the part of all of this congregation to make sure that those who either are not going to the feast or do not have enough financial capacity on their own to go to the feast, but would go and could go if they had help, to make sure that all of those people are provided for. And that's a that's a wonderful thing, because that is the spirit of the feast. Go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the eternal is your strength. So we rejoice before God, and to whatever degree we're able, we help other people to rejoice. And we share the joy. We share the blessings that God has given us. And so the Levites quieted all the people, saying, "Be still, for the day is holy. Do not be grieved." And so they were encouraging them to be positive, to be excited, to rejoice in the feast. And it says in verse 12, all the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions, and rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. You obviously understand those words. I've been very encouraged and impressed with the generosity and the capacity of the church to serve each other, to help each other, to take care of those who might have special needs. And of course, for just your information and education, you know that we have a central fund into which excess festival tithe goes, from which we then try to take care of all those who have needs across the country. In other words, instead of keeping it in the local area and just helping your own people, we put it into a central fund so that it can be equitably distributed throughout the country. Those distributing it and those requesting it, that is in the ministry, try to be very judicious in making sure that it's all equitable and it's all done fairly and properly. But we also recognize that sometimes you want to help somebody personally, and you're free to do that. You don't have to send all of your money into the headquarters office if you choose to help somebody personally. Now, again, in order to keep it generally equitable across the board, make sure that some have-not areas are able to be helped from some have areas, we tend to collect it all in a central location. And we encourage you to send in whatever excess tithes you might have for that purpose, even now after the feast. If you find you came home and you had a great time, but you still have money left over, of course, that can be used next year to help those who are less blessed and comfortable than you are. So we encourage you to do that, but we also do not limit or prevent you from saying, hey, I'm going to set aside a certain amount of money to give to this needy person next year so that this person can go and keep the feast. And generally speaking, here in the Houston congregation, we have been able to receive from the central fund adequate funds to send those who have needs to the feast, but in some cases you have added to that and made it a little more comfortable for some, and that's perfectly acceptable as well. The point here is that spiritually speaking, keeping the feast includes helping others to keep the feast, sharing with others. Some of us have family responsibilities, extended family perhaps that cannot make it to the feast without some help. In our case, we generally try to help family members who don't have the same kind of opportunities that we have, and I think many of you do that as well. But that is part of the process. It's part of planning for the feast, is to plan your budget, plan how to use your money, choose your priorities, figure out who to help and when to help them, or what to send in to headquarters. Now, let me take time here just for a minute to mention that this is distinct from what we call the tithe of the tithe, which is our term entirely. You won't find that terminology used in this context in the Bible. The tithe of the tithe is simply the way we determined that we would use God's principles to finance the feast by, in a sense, charging everybody who comes to the feast a fee. Now, we don't do that, do we? See, I'm talking in analogy here. If I were to go to the AARP convention this year, if I were old enough, if I would go to the what are you laughing about, Susan? If I would go to the AARP convention this year, they would charge me a certain fee to even come and participate. And then I'd have my hotel and my food and all those things additionally. but they charge a fee. We don't charge a fee to come to the feast, but there are all kinds of expenses associated with keeping the feast, right? We have to have a hall. We have to have various kinds of activities scheduled. We do special things for the seniors and others. And so there are expenses to be paid for making the feast happen. It's a big convention. And so instead of saying, okay, everybody pay $300, or everybody pay $50, or everybody pay $1,000, or whatever it is, we simply use God's principle and say, hey, you should give according to what you have. You should give according to what you're able. So we say, when you come to the spring and start making feast plans, you take a tenth of your festival money, and you send that in to the central office to pay all the expenses that the feast requires. And you don't pay a fee directly. You send in voluntarily a 10% of what you have. And that money goes into a specific restricted fund that is used to pay for the expenses of the Feast of Tabernacles. So there is a difference between the saving up and giving to others and giving a specific amount into the central fund for serving others in the sense of helping them to attend the feast. Now, for example, each summer, Robert Pierce, as the festival advisor, and I sit down, Mr. Pierce perhaps, and look at who's going to need help to go to the feast. And we say to them, if you're going to need help to go to the feast, you need to put in an application for help. And they put in an application, and we have a formula that tells them how much money it's going to cost them to go to the feast. And generally, that's their local assigned site, because we don't generally give funds for people to go to Europe or to go to India or go to Hawaii. If we give funds to people, it's to help them be at the feast, and that basically means the local closest feast site. But that happens, and each year in the last 2 years that I've been here, we have received the amounts we requested. Now, we're careful in how we budget and judiciously ask for that amount, but we've been given what we've asked for. And so those who need to have money to go to the feast have been able to be helped. But that's because people like you generously send in their tithe of the tithe in the spring. Because we have to look at that fund and say, here's how much budget we have. Here's how many people we have asking for money. Can we match it up? And thus far, that has worked. And we appreciate that very, very much. Well, there are other things we could talk about in terms of your support systems for your trip and the things you leave behind. The things have to be taken care of while you're away. I don't want to drag this out, and I see the clock is turning. But this is all a matter of prayer and faith, isn't it? It's a matter of believing God when he says, you come to the feast and obey me and rejoice before me and serve me and learn to fear me, and I will bless you. And God does bless his people accordingly. And when all is done, and we've done the work that we have to do in preparation and planning and budgeting and giving and sharing, then we go to the feast and we're free to rejoice. We're free to have a good time, to know that we've done our part and that we can rejoice before God and learn of him. And there's no more exciting spiritual experience probably in the church today than keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. There's no more effective learning experience than keeping the Feast of Tabernacles before God with his people. I repeat again what Dennis said earlier, just a joyous occasion in Park City, a joyous spirit, a room filled with excitement, enthusiasm, and joy day by day. And a wonderful experience all in all, no questions asked, because God was there, God's spirit was there, God's people was there. We're there, and we had a wonderful time. Let me close with Psalm 122. Psalm 122. This is one of the psalms of ascent that were used to accompany the going up to keep the feast. Psalm 122. The title in my Bible is The Joy of Going to the House of the Eternal, because there is great joy, and we anticipate the feast, and we'll start anticipating it now right away. We'll start talking about next year, and that is as it should be. I was glad when they said to me, let us go into the house of the Eternal. Our feet have been standing within your gates, O Jerusalem. Jerusalem is built as a city that is compact together, where the tribes go up, the tribes of the Eternal. And you see people coming into the feast from all over the country. To the testimony of Israel, to give thanks to the name of the Eternal. For thrones are set there for judgment, the thrones of the house of David. And of course, that's not only true in Jerusalem, we picture it at the Feast of Tabernacles. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they prosper who love you. Peace be within your walls, prosperity within your palaces. For the sake of my brethren and companions, I will now say, peace be within you. Because of the house of the Eternal our God, I will seek your good. God's name is placed wherever the feast site is placed, and we go there to appear before God and to rejoice before God. And as we've heard in these reports today, it's a wonderful experience. It's one most of us have had repeatedly. It's one we don't want to ever give up. So I hope that we will do our part to plan and to budget and to look forward to the Feast of Tabernacles with great anticipation and enthusiasm, even as we remember it today, both in our reports, in the potluck, in the discussion of the feast activities, wherever we might have been. Let's rejoice on the one hand with what has been, and rejoice in anticipation of next year's Feast of Tabernacles, because God says, these are my feasts.